Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com.
Citizens of the Republic of Spoilerverse, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Ken Cregan. That's Mr. Horsley. And today on the show, well, it's Robert Hewitt Wolf, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, man. The guy who wrote A Fistful of Deities for Next Generation, which is one of the coolest episodes in the holodeck, and worked on DS9, helped bring Andromeda. Dude, I love the holodeck episodes are my favorite ones, like by far. I love.
Are they really?
I love any of the episodes that kind of switch it up a little bit, like the holodeck episodes or away mission episodes, episodes where it's not just on the ship. Those are the ones I like the most. I mean, I like the ones on the ship because the holodeck ones wouldn't be cool without those ones, but the ones where it's like on the ship and does all this stuff, that's my bread and butter for what I like to watch.
That's your jam.
That's my jam, man. It goes on my bread and butter. So I have bread, butter, and jam. I love it.
Yeah, Robert did a lot, man. Was part of the Andromeda series. They had him develop that after Gene Roddenberry died, and that was one of the TV series that Gene was working on. Well, I don't think he was working on it like at the studio, but he was writing the outline and doing all that kind of stuff, and then he took it over and brought it to TV, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and then I mean, and in conjunction with Andromeda, he's written books and written for. He was an executive producer on the Dresden Files. I mean, this guy's done a lot of stuff.
That's what it was. The Dresden Files, dude. I loved that show. I was really freaking disappointed when they actually stopped.
A lot of people were.
Yeah, and you know, when you get into this and you start listening, check out for when I buy Robert's book.
Yeah.
During the call.
Live on the air. We've done that several times for people too. It's kind of funny.
Well, because you get excited and then, you know, I don't know. But it's called The Goblin Crown.
Oh, that's what it was. Yes.
Yeah. You guys can check it out when you can, but you'll hear about it right now. Hey, guys. Welcome back to the show. Today, we are honored and super pleased. Well, he's a consulting producer on Prodigal Son right now. He co-created The Dresden Files, one of my favorite sci-fi shows that was on, and I was really bummed when they canceled it after a season. He's a co-creator of Andromeda. You're also a co-creator of Dresden Files. Co-creator of Andromeda with Gene Roddenberry, which is amazing, and a producer on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Robert Wolf, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Happy to be here.
Roddenberry, how'd that happen?
Well, that was posthumous. I actually never met Gene. I started on Deep Space Nine a little bit after he passed away. And so I was approached by Tribune Entertainment, who had the rights to mine his unproduced works to create television.
Yeah.
And they'd already done Earth Final Conflict, and they wanted to do a sci-fi show. And they had Kevin Sorbo committed to be the lead, and that's it. That's really all they had. And they had the vague idea that there might be something worth doing in Gene's unproduced works.
Yeah.
And so they just kind of gave me access to his files. And I think I went over to Majel's house. I'd met Majel before because she'd been on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And so I went over there and read a whole bunch of what he had. And I think I took some with. There were some copies. I can't remember. And the truth is, like, unlike Earth Final Conflict, he never wrote a script for Andromeda. So they actually commissioned two different proposals, one for a starship-based show, which I did, and one for a planet-based show, which coincidentally, I didn't know it, but David Weddle and Brad Thompson did.
Yeah.
And they, Tribune, and I guess Kevin preferred mine. The only thing they liked better from David and Brad's proposal was their title, Andromeda. So they asked me if I could call mine Andromeda. And I was like, sure, I'll just change the name of the ship. And yeah, went from there. I mean, the truth is like, you know, the idea of a sentient starship was Gene's. I took from his New Genesis stuff the idea of a guy suspended in time for 300 years rebuilding civilization. So that was genes.
Yeah.
The genetically engineered human bad guys were also genes, and they were called the Tyrians in his proposals.
Yeah.
So I renamed them the Nietzscheans, changed them up a little bit, but I called Tyr. And those were the main starting points, and then I just went, you know.
Yeah.
Went
and it was on for like 5 years, right?
Yeah, 5 years, 110 episodes. It did quite well. I mean, they made that show for nothing. That was actually one of the, I parted ways with that show, unpleasantly, ultimately. And one of my big issues with them was trying to convince them to spend more money to get something that looked better.
Yeah.
And would have a longer shelf life. But one of the issues with Tribune was that they were ultimately, at their core, a newspaper company. And newspapers have no shelf life.
Yeah.
You know, newspaper is fish wrap the next day.
Right.
And they make really no money on ancillary stuff. I mean, there's not really a tail to like newspapers, you know?
Right, right.
And
right.
So that wasn't really how they were wired. And so that was a little bit of a
they're back like, wait, we're making our profit margin. Why would we want to do more?
Right. Exactly. Like we make it for X, we sell it for Y, we make the difference between X and Y, we're done.
That's unfortunate. And,
yeah, I mean, you know, I think you see it when you watch the show. I think if we'd spend a little more money, I think a lot of the, you know, the physical production would certainly be better.
Right.
And, you know, I think also if we'd stuck with my approach to storytelling in the long run, I think the stories would have been more interesting and had more legs. But you know, it was great. It was a great opportunity. It taught me how to be a showrunner. And it was a lot of fun while it lasted.
Yeah.
And yeah, it went on for 110 and it's still on. I mean, I think it's on Pluto now.
Yeah,
so people can watch it with commercials.
I saw it like 6 months ago, maybe, like just on broadcast television.
Yeah, but it's around. It's bouncing around. Lionsgate owns it now, I think. And I think, you know, people are watching it, so that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's had some legs anyway.
Yeah, it's well, you know, man, those sci-fi nerds, man, they latch onto something. That's it for a long time.
Well, you know, and there are a lot of people who grew up with that show, and I remember it extremely fondly, and so that always makes me happy to hear that those characters meant a lot to a lot of people.
That's awesome.
And, you know, a lot of people watched it when it was out.
So, growing up, you're a big Highline fan.
I was, yeah. I don't know where you found that, but yes, I was. Yeah, that was my big introduction to science fiction was Heinlein. You know, he wrote these...
Was it Starship Troopers?
YA books. Well, actually, but what I started reading first was not Starship Troopers, because I think I started reading his books when I was maybe 10 years old.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stuff I read at first were his YA novels.
Yeah.
Which is like Citizen of the Galaxy and Time for the Stars.
You know, it's funny, Robert. Do you like to go by Robert or Bob or?
I go by Robert. My dad was Bob.
Okay,
so,
perfect. Yeah. So it's funny you say that, Robert, is a lot of people don't know all the YA novels that Heinlein did. They just think that he's highbrow sci-fi. And that's like, he's a great writer for young generations to get into that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he wrote a ton of those. And in fact, Starship Troopers was originally supposed to be a YA, and it was so dark, and eventually he decided to age it up, you know. Yeah. But the protagonist, I mean, is still Johnny is still like, you know, he's 18 years old.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think there's a rumor that maybe his wife worked on those YAs with him. I'm not sure.
Oh.
But she's not credited for sure. But
right.
But yeah, they're delightful. I mean, some of them are very dated. You know, there's like all this stuff set on Mars with Martians and on Venus with like giant, like dragon, like whatever the Venusians were.
Right. But they're so awesome. I think that's
between planets, right? Yeah. Between planets.
Right.
But yeah, there's some great, they're great stories. They're really fun adventures. And the truth is like the thing I really like about Heinlein is like, unlike some of his contemporaries, to be honest, is his prose is really good.
Yeah.
Like he's a really good writer. You know, I could take issue with some of his politics occasionally.
Sure.
Or I could take more specifically, I could take issue with the way some people interpret his politics.
Right.
But boy, his prose still holds up. And that you can't say that for all those golden age guys.
That's true. That is true. As a matter of fact, I know that didn't he he influenced you enough to where you actually tried writing a novel in fifth grade and then again in eighth grade.
That is true. Yeah. I tried to write a couple different books and then I tried again in college. I didn't finish any of them. And then I finally published my first novel like 4 years ago.
Oh, congrats. And
thank you. Yeah. My third one's coming out in July. It's the final book of the trilogy and they're YA. They're young adult fantasy.
So what is the name of this trilogy? Like, let's get some voices out there to tell people, go check out Robert Wolf in this novel, especially if one's coming out in July, man, we got to pump it.
Yeah, let's pump some books. Yeah. So the series is called Billy Smith and the Goblins. And the first book is called The Goblin Crown. The second book is called The Fallen Star. And the final book, like I said, is coming out like late July this year, is called The Final Drop. And the basic premise is it's a modern day sort of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where three modern high school students on their first day of school mysteriously get transported to like a fantasy land where there's just been a giant war between humans and goblins, and the goblins have lost, and the goblins have a prophecy that whenever they're in trouble, a human child will appear in the caverns beneath their city to save them. And these three kids appear in the caverns, and a desperate goblin finds them and thinks, one of you must be our king. One of you is destined to save us, because the humans have decided they've had enough of all these wars with the goblins, and they're coming to commit genocide. They're coming to wipe out every last goblin.
That sounds awesome. I want to read that.
Goblins are the good guys. And I think Deep Space Nine fans will recognize, you know, some of the themes. And there's a lot. I try to have fun the same way we do with Klingon. There's a whole goblin glossary in the back of every book.
Yeah.
With some goblin terms and stuff like that.
Oh, this is great.
So yeah, lots of world building, and ultimately, like, it is high fantasy, and it, you know, it does build to, I just wrote, you know, for the last book, I wrote a 100-page long battle for the final book. So there's a giant effing battle, and it's not even the end, but there's a giant, you know, giant battles and all kinds of daring do.
Oh my God.
All that kind of stuff.
Is it on audiobook as well, or just?
Yeah, it is. It's on Audible.
It's on Audible.
And it's on Kindle, and it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of that usual place where you would find books.
So if I go to Audible, and I go to...
They're all there.
Robert Wolf with an E.
Was this like, are you going to buy the book on the air, Kendrick?
Yeah, I am. I'm totally going to buy the book on the air. Are you kidding?
Use your Audible credits. I have so many Audible credits.
I've got Audible credits. That's what I'm going to do.
If people listening have unused Audible credits, just go get Goblin Crown. What do you got to lose? They're just going to expire, man.
Exactly. Grab that. Goblin Crown.
There it is.
There it is.
Like 4.5 stars, right?
Boom. Yep.
Well reviewed.
There it is. Boom, boom. Buy now with one credit. Confirm purchase. Done.
Hey,
done, awesome. Son.
Hey, I already made money on this podcast.
See, right. But you weren't expecting that one.
Yeah, no. I just made a buck, I think.
Sweet. Totally worth it.
Only $999,999 to go.
That's right, man. Scratch it out a dollar at a time.
Oh, I love this.
We just sold them to China, so they're actually going to show up in Mandarin at some point. I think once the third book comes out, I think they're going to put them all out.
Oh man, I'm so excited to actually sit down and listen to. I work so much, and then we do this. And Johnny and I started this podcast in 2017, and it just turned into this huge passion of ours. And now we've had over 350 episodes. We've talked to all these, and we've talked to some amazing people. And, you know, it just expands, you know, you're constantly working on something. So audiobooks has been my saving grace because I was a ferocious reader growing up. I started Lord of the Rings in fourth grade. I didn't know what it was.
That's about when I read it too. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to read it again in eighth grade to really understand it, but I totally read it.
I remember doing a book report on Wizard of Earthsea in fourth grade for sure. Which is another one of my favorites.
Did people
the only
like,
thing
what
you're going to miss on that Audible book is you're not going to be able to see the map and you're not going to be able to go to the glossary at the end.
Oh, that's okay. Because when I see the book at the bookstore, I'll purchase it. And then I'll be like, okay, I'm going to go back to this.
I don't think you'll see it at the bookstore. It's a smaller publisher, but you definitely can find it on Amazon and stuff like that.
Well, I'll just do that. I'll just get it on Amazon. I like to have, if I can get it both, then I'm going to get both. And if you have some things that are some ancillary stuff in there, then I want to check it out.
Oh, there's all, yeah. There's three appendices in every book. Cast the characters and the dictionary, and then there's a little map.
See, you're hitting all my geek buttons. This is perfect.
It's funny, you know, when I wrote the books, we should get to television too, but I just want to, when I wrote the first book, I gave it to a couple kids that are my honorary nephews.
Yeah.
And the first thing they said, their very first note was, where's the map? It needs a map. And I was like, all right. So I drew a map.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. You know, our tagline here is, well, our tagline in Ocean's a podcast, we are Cthulhu. But at the end of every show, we end it with, open your mind, open the mind and read more.
Nice.
We're big on reading because we love comic books and books. We try to have as many creative people on, but we have mostly writers. It's because we just, you know, we love the medium. So it's good.
Most writers are pretty fun to talk to, I find. I mean, I spend my whole life talking to writers.
Heck yeah.
It's a fun thing to do.
So, Star Trek The Next Generation, you wrote the episode A Fistful of Datas, which is a wonderful title, by the way. I hope you came up with that one.
It's a wonderful
episode, too.
Originally, I called it The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon. And then, while I was writing, and I was like, no, A Fistful of Datas is even better.
Yeah, so it is. I mean, I guess you could have went with High Picard, but...
No, but Picard's not in the Western, and A Fistful of Datas, like, literally there is A Fistful of Datas by the end of the episode, and so that, to me, was
perfect
than The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon. Although The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon wasn't too shabby.
That isn't too shabby. But in my research, was this the third attempt at trying to get Paramount to buy a script from you?
Yeah. Well, I was pitching. I was actually pitching stories, so I didn't write the script. So back in the day, Star Trek had a pretty open door policy. Next Generation, they invited people to pitch all the time. And there were a couple different ways you could get into pitch. You could be an established writer. You could send them a sample and they would read it. And if they liked it, they would invite you in. I was sort of an established writer. I'd been around. I had an agent. I nearly sold a big feature. And then it all fell apart.
Yeah.
But... my agent represented Joe Manosky, and so she got me in. She got them to invite me in. They read that feature that I almost sold, which I later sold it twice, but it still never got made.
But and you so sold they it read twice. That.
I cast the checks. It would have been nice to get it made. Yeah. And then they read it. They liked it enough that they invited me in to pitch. I pitched them. The first time I pitched them, two stories. They didn't buy either one of them. The next time I pitched them two stories. Didn't buy either one of them, but they invited me back a third time, and I figured, you know, that was it. Third time is nothing. And you're pitching to the actual writers of the show, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm pitching to, like, Ron Moore and Jerry Taylor and all that stuff. And so the third time, I think I was pitching to, like, a whole room full of, like, Joe Manosky. I think Ron was there. I want to say Brannon and maybe even Renee were there. It was, like, a full room, which was very unusual. And I pitched them the first story. I had it really worked out, and I was very excited about it. It was a time travel story. And they dug it, but they were like, we're shooting this Time Zero right now, and we don't need another time travel story.
Right.
Especially not one where you go back to Earth, the historical period and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, crap. And I was sitting on this couch and I was sitting next to the arm of the couch, and I actually banged my head on the arm of the couch.
Right.
So I was like, so frustrated. I was like, all right, I got this other idea. Worf goes into the holodeck with Alexander to play cowboys and Indians in the Old West, and they're the sheriffs, and then suddenly, like, Data is testing out this thing, and he infects the holodeck with his personality, and suddenly all the other people in the holodeck drama are Data, and the only way that Worf can, and the safeguards are now off, and the only way Worf can end the program is to beat Data in a gunfight. And they were like, yeah.
I like sold. It.
So that was it. Yeah, it was very exciting.
And from that just opened the door to do so much more within that whole realm, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of the way it was there. I mean, the thing about Michael Piller and Jerry was that they were really interested in finding and nurturing talent. I think that they believed, I know Michael believed, that Star Trek was such a peculiar thing that it was very hard sometimes to take established TV writers and teach them how to write Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that it was better to find people who sort of had the instinct to write Star Trek and teach them how to be TV writers. And so a lot of people... got their career started because Star Trek either Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, or Voyager, bought a story from them and then let them write a script and then gave them another script. And that's sort of what happened to me. I wrote the script for Fistful of Data's. They liked it enough, although Brandon did a big rewrite on it. And so Brandon has a co-writing credit on it. Brandon did some terrific work on there on it. But then they liked what I did enough that they hired me to write a freelance Deep Space Nine before the show was even on the air. And that was Q-less. And they had the story already. They weren't happy with where it was at. They asked me what I thought. I told them how I would restructure it. They liked what I had to say. We rebroke the story. They sent me off to write it. And then based on that script, they hired me on to staff on Deep Space Nine.
That's an incredible story though, because there's a lot of moving parts to break down.
I mean, you know, it was just like, you know, succeeding in Hollywood is like persistence plus talent plus luck. And I just kind of got all three of those in that period. I'd been banging my head against the wall for like 4 or 5 years to try to get in.
Yeah.
I had enough talent that when they gave me an assignment, I did it well. And I was just sort of lucky to get in the door in the first place.
Yeah.
To pitch them a story they needed at the time. The fact that they were all busy and they didn't have, no one had time to write it. And so they liked my work enough that they let me do it.
So
I mean, and the fact that Deep Space Nine was coming along and suddenly there are all these job openings. I mean, it was just, you know, a lot of luck involved.
Think but, the persistence know, and luck was more important than the talent, or do you think that talent needs to be there for people to even look at your stuff?
I think it's, you got to have all three.
Yeah.
I think the talent has to be there. You need the persistence because you need to keep going until that the luck finally skin. Happens. Because luck is just like, you know, persistence is a huge part of luck, right? If you stick with something long enough, you will get, hopefully you will get some opportunities.
Yeah.
Then you need the talent to fulfill those opportunities.
Right. When your opportunity arises, you better have the talent to actually impress.
Yeah. I mean, cause honestly, like, you know, we had a lot of freelancers. I was then on the other side of that desk on Deep Space Nine, and I was hearing pitches all the time and working with freelancers. And, you know, some of them would come into pitch and they would just bomb the pitch. It was heartbreaking. And then sometimes you'd give people a story and they would, you know, clearly the way they would write the story document, you could tell they weren't going to be able to pull off the script.
Right.
Or they'd write the script and it'd be a page one and they wouldn't get invited to do another one.
Right.
They might get invited to contribute a story again, but they'd never get a chance to write a script again.
Do they come back to you and ask you to, hey, do you want to be a producer on Deep Space Nine? Or did you literally apply for the job because you knew it was opened?
No, not a producer. The staff writer, which is the lowest ranking. It's the beginning rank of writer.
Right.
And they approached me to do Q-less. I just was like, sure, I'd love to. And then they invited me. So I wasn't like consciously pursuing the staff writer position. I was just trying to get freelance gigs. But I mean, I certainly enjoyed working on the shows. And I was very excited to be able to be the staff writer on the show. It's a huge opportunity. That's like, you know, that was such a great environment for a writer to, you know, and I was writing all the time and working with wonderful people, and it was great, man.
Yeah, that's cool. Did you work your way up to producer then, or did I?
I did. Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know. Do you guys know how writer ranks work?
No. Please tell me. Okay, educate.
Progression. Sure. So writers have ranks just like in the military. This is how I explained to my dad, who was an army officer.
Yeah.
And so staff writer is the lowest rank. When you start on a show, you start as a staff writer, and that is like being a second lieutenant.
Okay.
Then the next promotion is story editor. Now you're a first lieutenant. Then executive story editor, you're a captain. And once you're a captain, you have some responsibilities. You might even be supervising some other writers and stuff like that. Then co-producer, that's a major. Producer, that's a lieutenant colonel. Now you're in the big time. Now
you're in the thick of it.
Supervising producer, now you're a colonel. And co-EP, you're like a one-star general. And then EP and up, you're like five-star general.
What was,
and so
you've kind of ran the gambit though, because you've got quite a few shows underneath your belt. When you think back through your career, what do you think? At what position do you think you're the happiest?
I mean, honestly, I'm probably the happiest as the executive producer and showrunner because, I mean, I'm the most stressed out.
Yeah.
But I'm also doing something that's entirely mine. It's a great challenge, you know. Yeah. It's a huge challenge. You're basically running the show. When you're a showrunner, you've got 200 people who work for you. It's a multi-million dollar product that you're putting out, 13 to 24 times a year.
Yeah.
And, it's a union, you've got like a union factory that's making your widget, and your widget costs $5 million to make or whatever the heck it costs. And so it's definitely the most stressful position. I guess, I'd probably say I was the very happiest. Like, I was certainly like my life was wonderful when I was an executive producer, but not the showrunner on the show.
Yeah.
Which is like, I was on Elementary, I wrote 16 of those. I supervised a lot of other writers, but ultimately like all the stress fell on Rob.
Right.
Doherty. But I think I'd probably say I'm probably happiest when I'm the showrunner.
That's awesome.
So,
when you're starting out writing, and you're a staff writer, do you feel like writers are like still today? Because I kind of feel like we've entered into this golden age of television in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
All these amazing shows that have just come out back to back to back. And it seems like it started around, I don't know when it really started. I always think of Heroes for some reason back in 2005. But
sure.
But, it was building up to it.
Deep Space Nine.
it was totally Deep Space Nine and Andromeda. I'm sorry. But
no, I won't try to take Andromeda. I won't try to put Andromeda on that pedestal, but I'll say the golden age television started with Deep Space Nine. How about that?
Exactly. But you know what I'm saying, though? Like there's just like so many, like Elementary. That's a great show. That was a great concept to bring Holmes to America and have this whole thing, and Lucy Liu be his Watson and just go through everything. That was a brilliant show. And it seems like there's a lot of them that are not doing that concept, but I mean, just this, it's just some amazing writing happening right now. But do you still feel like writers are still stumbling over the cleverness of a script as opposed to concentrating on characters, especially in TV show over movies?
I think it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that TV lends itself to character more than cleverness.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that is why the writing feels better on television sometimes than it does in features, because it's really about character. It's really about two people talking to each other. It's really about the dialogue. And you can't dazzle them with special effects,
Right.
I mean, I guess you can. Game of Thrones can.
Right.
But you wouldn't have given a crap about the final battle against the White Walkers if you didn't love those characters and fall in love with them over the course of all that time. And I think that's where television's strength lies. I mean, television needs to create characters that you want to invite into your home, either for like a 6-hour binge, or, four nights in a row or whatever,
yeah,
or for once a week for years,
Are you a binger or a once a week guy?
It depends on the show. Well, honestly, now I'm a binger, because who watches a television show when it's actually on the air,
Right.
So I'll watch like 3-4 episodes of something in an evening.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way most people consume television now, or a huge number of people. I know there are still people watching broadcast.
Well, I know Orville, we talked to some people from Orville, and when it comes out on Hulu, it's going to release once a week, just like it would be on broadcast. And I was like, okay, I'll watch it because I'm a fan of that show, and I'll watch it once a week.
Yeah.
But that's not to say I would love it if they dumped it all at once. You know what I mean?
I mean, most of the time, I guess there are some shows we watch once a week. Certainly Game of Thrones we watch once a week because we wanted to see it before there were any spoilers. I think we watched Watchmen the same way.
Yeah. But they did such a great job making that an event.
Yeah. Yeah. An event type show like that. But a lot of shows, there's so many shows these days. It's almost people don't all talk about the same show at the same time. So the spoilers aren't out there anymore in a lot of ways. And so I'll sit down and watch, I just watched The Boys. Hadn't really heard any spoilers about it. Watched the whole thing in like 2 nights.
What'd you think?
I enjoyed it a lot. It was a cool deconstruction of the superhero genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of clever stuff. And you had an identifiable character who to bring you through it. And I think that it's Stewie, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, you get it, it brings you into the world. You get who this kid is. You get he's messed up now, and he's trying to figure things out and get some justice for his girlfriend. and you know, it brings you through, and lots of other, you know, a lot of memorable characters and a lot of fun scenes and sequences and stuff like that. So I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
I do think that there are sometimes you watch shows where the cleverness does get in the way of the characters.
Yeah.
And I think there's also been a lot of feature writers coming into television, and a lot of them are great and do really great work, and occasionally get someone who comes into television from features, and they've just so been trained in that spectacle model, you know, or that's how their head is wired. And then they try to translate the television, and even with a giant budget,
it doesn't translate.
You just can't do it. It doesn't really work.
Right.
I mean, it can work, but like even Game of Thrones, man, so many battles in that show take place like off screen, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or they'll arrive like in the middle of the battle, or Tyrion gets his head bashed in 5 minutes into the battle. You know what I mean?
Right.
So like, there's a lot of like, they did a lot of very clever things to avoid like, you know, committing to situations that they couldn't really put on screen. And every once in a while you watch one of these shows that is based more on like high concepts and special effects.
Yeah.
And the characters aren't there. And even the execution, the visual effects isn't that great. I mean, it's good, you know, it's certainly better than what we could have done 20 years ago.
Right.
But if the characters aren't there, if I don't know what I'm watching and why I'm watching it and what I'm rooting for.
Well, you bring up Game of Thrones. What did you, I mean, understanding how a show is ran and how they come up with decisions, and they had a good set amount of books at the beginning, and then they ran out of those books with the last two seasons. They're all kind of basically,
three, I think.
Yeah, just using George R. R. Martin as a consultant of what they should do and what he thought about doing. What'd you think of the last, with the way Cersei dies? Was that something that you would have done, or would you have changed that in a big way?
You know, it's tough for me to second guess that, because
do you want armchair quarterback that one?
I'm just not like, I'm not a big fan of Monday morning quarterbacking in general. Like, you know, they did some spectacular work even after they ran out of the books. And I think, you know, the Battle of Winterfell is one of the best, you know, the episode before that.
The Battle
and
that of the Bastards.
The Battle of the Bastards too, but like the final battle with the White Walkers is amazing.
Yeah,
you know?
It is.
The Battle of the Bastards is terrific.
Yeah.
You know? And so they did some amazing work, and you know, did they completely stick the landing? I mean, pop culture probably says no.
Right. That's the only scene that when I look, because you invest so much time into something that's finite, you know, and that's,
yeah,
it's not like a series that was going to go on forever. There was a set amount of episodes they were going to do. Even the show runners were like, we're going to end it, you know, and they kept playing with 8 years, 10 years, you know what I mean? Whatever it was going to be, but they knew it was ending. And I just felt like, all that time, and that's how you do it. I was so, I don't know. I think I felt like you didn't get the satisfaction for all the crap that she did.
although, you know, she had a pretty horrible death.
Yeah.
And everything she cared about was destroyed. I didn't mind it so much.
That's true.
I think, you know, one of the things
I didn't think about it that way. I think I just thought of the physical harm.
Sure. But like, you know, her mental state at that point, like she is pretty, look, she is symbolically buried even before she's buried. Right.
So, yeah. Well, that's a good way to put it.
So I think that I understand where they were coming from. I think one of the things, having worked on so many shows, is knowing that sometimes in the room, the decisions that you make creatively are actually constrained by certain other factors that the audience will never know about.
Yeah.
Budget, actor availability issues, like scheduling issues. There's so many things, you know, that can happen. And so when you're actually sitting down there, you know, I mean, you do your very best, and certainly, you know, I've written some stinker episodes of television. And I didn't set out to write a stinker.
Right.
Just, you know, sometimes these things happen. I'm not even saying that that's a stinker. I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, the reason I don't like the Monday morning quarterback is because I'm not those guys. I wasn't in that room. I don't know what they,
trying to. Definitely don't want to cast dispersions on people that you don't go into something like that thinking, let me just totally mess this up. You know what I mean? You go in thinking, I'm going to put my whole heart into this.
So high. And they set that bar that high because they did such a
wonderful
work.
Job. Yeah.
You know, so expectations for those final couple episodes were like sky high. Like matching those expectations is really, really hard.
How can
Sticking
you?
A landing of a show, even a great show. I mean, there's people who will argue that like Mad Men's ending isn't great, you know, or they'll argue that Sopranos didn't end in a satisfying way. Yep. I mean, I kind of disagree in both of those cases.
Yeah.
But there are people who will argue that. And so there's nothing, I think there's nothing harder than sticking the landing in a, at the end of a big long show. And, you know, we got to do that twice in Elementary. And I think we did a pretty good job both times.
Yeah.
I wasn't around to do it on Deep Space Nine. I already left. I didn't get to do it on Andromeda. I kind of got to do it in my books. Finally, I did get to do it in my books. The third book does conclude the story. And it's just nice. Like a very tricky bit of craft. It's like, you know, it's tough.
Sticking that landing is hard. That's true.
Really hard. Most shows, when you think about it, like most shows fail to reach that expectation.
Yeah.
I mean, most long-running shows, they end with a whimper, or the last episode is like, or they didn't even get to do the last episode they wanted, like Alphas, where like the ending is like, what the hell just happened? There's a whole episode of Big Bang Theory about how horrible the ending of Alphas is.
I was going to ask you.
Episode of Big Bang Theory about like us screwing up the end of that show. Well, we were told we were going to get a third season when we wrote that episode, and then they decided we weren't going to.
Me and my girl sat and watched Alphas, and we didn't know of it when it was on live, right? We binged it. We're like, oh my God, this is so good. And then that whole final scene happens, and we're looking it up, and I'm like, where's the next season?
Well, that's what we were asking ourselves, too. Because we never would have written that ending.
Yeah.
If we had thought we weren't going to come back.
But it's kind of a cool indication. But it's kind of like, everybody did die.
Yeah. The end. Only Gary lived.
It's like one of those jokes that you tell people, oh yeah, they all die at the end. When they don't, you know what I mean? But then your buddy's sitting there going, oh my God, are they really going to die? Or is it, because even though you know that's implausible, not everybody's going to die at the end, but you start thinking, are they all going to die at the end? And I tell my buddy who got into Alphas, that's what I told him. I said, everybody dies at the end. And the same thing. He was like, oh my God, no, they don't all die at the end. I said, just keep watching. And then he came back. He was like, oh my God.
I mean, the truth is they're not even supposed to be dead. They're right. Just all supposed to be lying there in shock after having gotten blasted by that promycin, that's 4400. But having gotten hit by the you know, zappy lighty thing that was supposed to like awaken Alpha's powers in some of them. And it was going to let us like shuffle the deck a little bit and maybe change some people's abilities and introduce new characters and give some characters that didn't have abilities and take away abilities from other people. And so that was the goal. Like that was the idea. And instead, we just get like not since dinosaurs has there been a more depressing ending to a television show.
I loved that show, though. I thought you guys did a brilliant job on it. I really did. I mean, it goes to show. I mean, we literally sat and watched both seasons in less than a week. You know,
well, God bless, man. I mean, it was a fun show to do, and that was a great cast, and it was, you know, Zach was like. Had a great vision. Zach and Zach Penn and Michael Carnow, who created the show, had a great vision for the show.
Yeah.
And I thought the tone was really fun and it looked great. And, you know, I feel like that show should have gone a lot longer.
Good. Know? I mean, I always look at lighting for some reason. It always jumps out at me when the way, cause it, to me, it sets the tone of how the show feels as a whole. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like it kind of, without having like the overarching narration going on, it gave me a sense of an older sleuth show.
Yeah, that's sort of what it was supposed to feel like. It was supposed to feel like, you know, a sort of a bit of a throwback in some ways, and that these guys were like unlikely heroes, and they were trying to, you know, muddle their way through this investigatory role that they've been given, and they were doing their best, and they were deeply flawed, and it was a really fun show to do. Yeah, that one hurt. That was a sad one when they pulled the plug on that one.
Was Dresden Files similar in your mind? Because I thought Paul Blackthorne as Dresden was perfect.
Oh, he was so great. He was so great.
And I don't know, that show was a lot of fun, and I was super bummed that Sci-Fi didn't go all in on it, because I thought it was like, oh, this could be great for a while.
Same. I mean, the truth about Dresden Files is that like what I was saying before, like you don't really understand sometimes all the things that are happening behind the scenes that make things easier or harder. There were a lot of difficult things about making Dresden Files. It was an incredibly challenging situation for a lot of reasons, and I'm not going to go into any of them.
Right.
Oh no, you know what? I will go into one of them.
Yeah.
Here's what I will go into. So this is a film, this is a TV show about a wizard who investigates supernatural mysteries.
Yep.
What do you think are you more likely to investigate a supernatural mystery in the daytime, or is it more interesting to do it at night?
Well, for a TV show, it'd be more interesting at night. I mean,
yeah, if you are going to then do that and you're doing some mystery stuff, you probably want to go outside too, right? And go to some dark, creepy places.
Night Stalker taught us all of that,
right?
Of course. Yeah.
So we were shooting in Toronto and we started shooting at the end of October and we wrapped in February.
Yeah.
Do you know how freaking cold it is in Toronto at night in the winter?
I do, because I went to Toronto in December of 2016 and it was god awful cold.
It is so cold. It is so cold that when we shot the pilot, I don't know whether you remember, it didn't air the pilot. It aired as like episode 6. That was a whole political mess. But there was a scene where this like wizard puts a sword to Dresden's neck in an alley.
Yeah.
And it's daytime, but it was like dawn. It was like 8 in the morning. And we were in this alley, and the alley faced kind of northwest, which is the same direction the wind comes from the Arctic. It comes from the northwest. And it was shooting down that alley, and it was so cold that Paul was getting frostburn on his neck from the blade because the metal was freezing cold. And so we would take that sword and we would hold it up to a space heater that we were using to warm base camp.
Yeah.
Not base camp, but the tent where everybody like watches the monitors, until the sword was like red hot, like practically glowing. We would hand it to the actor who was supposed to put it to his, and by the time he got it to Paul's neck, it was freezing cold again. It was the craziest thing. Oh, wow. And so we, you know, Paul got really worn down. It was very difficult physically on the crew, though. It was a brutal cold winter. We were outdoors all the time. And, you know, it was just a really tough show to do.
And
there were other issues too, but that was like by far and away, like that was a huge challenge.
I was
up there the whole time supervising production. And I think I was getting, you know, I was so sick at one point.
Ugh.
I was working like 100 hours a week. And getting, you know, maybe if I was lucky, I was getting 6 hours of sleep a day.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
And then, you know, waking up at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and working until dawn, you know. And yeah, I've never been sicker on a production. It was pretty brutal.
Man. Well, you know what? Your passion came through because that show was great. It really was. I was seriously bummed when they canceled it for that second season. I was like, oh, because you could always kind of moved everything to Vancouver, right? Right.
We were subbing Chicago. We were doing a good job. I think we could have shot it. You know, the problem is, of course, like in the summer in Toronto, there is no night. Well, or there's a lot less daylight.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot more daylight. But we probably could have remounted the show, shot it at a slightly different time of year. It's one of those shows that, you know, people say this all the time in the businesses. If it could have gotten a second year, it would have gotten a fifth.
Right.
You know, I think that show was well built. And the truth is, they took our whole crew and our production designer and they put them all on Warehouse 13.
Oh, really? So, is that what happened?
Yeah.
So
a lot of our people went and did Warehouse 13. And
that was a fun show,
so
too.
So they clearly liked the physical look of it. And they liked, you know, they took some of our editors and all that kind of stuff. None of our writers and none of our cast. Oh, no, some of our cast, because Joe was recurring for us. And she was the female lead on Warehouse. And she was our vampire villain. So, you know.
Oh, my God, you're right. I didn't even put that two together.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. Plus, there was a writer's strike that year, too. And that probably didn't help things. And the difficulties behind the scenes were beyond just the – I just want to say none of this was the actors either. Like, Paul was amazing and wonderful the whole time and all that stuff.
Yeah, he's
awesome.
It was
just like there was a lot of politics. There were budgetary issues. There was a lot of – on that made the show like much harder to produce than it should have been, and I think that ultimately didn't weigh in its favor when it was time to look at the renewal or not.
But now you've been working on Prodigal Son.
I have.
What is Michael Sheen like?
super fun experience on that show.
Yeah. What is Michael Sheen like? That guy is an amazing actor.
I never got to work with him.
Oh, what?
Because he's amazing. I didn't get to work with him because I wrote an episode that he was not supposed to appear in at all anyway, because it was a scheduling issue. So I didn't get to write a scene for him. Although I did help on an episode where he was in it, but I never went to New York for that episode. So I did write some scenes for him, or help write some scenes for him. But then when it was time to finally shoot my episode and go to New York, we prepped the whole episode. Everything was going great. We shot a full day of episodes, and then we realized that basically New York was a plague hub, and yeah, we had to shut down. And so we never shot the episode.
So now you're
shut down, and the order got reduced by 2 episodes, and my episode never got shot.
Oh.
So yeah, so that was fun.
Hey,
but
Robert,
I did not get, that's all right, I did not get COVID-19, which was lucky.
Yeah,
I was in New York right in the middle of all that.
Oh man.
And you know, went to a Broadway play like a week before they realized that they needed to shut down
all those people.
Broadway plays.
Yeah, that's kind of lucky. I mean, cuz it spread like wildfire, cuz we're in Seattle.
Yeah.
And so we were like at the beginning of everything, it was ground zero, right? And
yeah, for sure.
And so I was like, "Oh, freaking out." And then when it hit New York, it was like, oh my God, it really put things in perspective for here.
Oh my God.
You know? Scary.
And like, we had a whole meeting with the crew. We were like, we're going to keep going. And it was the first day of shooting. We had a meeting with the crew. Like, we're going to keep going. We think we can do this safely. We're going to, you know, everyone is saying we can keep working.
Yeah.
And then the next day it was like, we're not going to.
Yeah. We're not going to put anybody at risk.
They were like, we hear this show shut down. We hear that show shut down. We hear this other show is not going to shoot anymore.
Yeah.
And we were like, we are not hearing that. That's not what we're hearing. That's not what the studio is telling us. And then it turned out it was all true. Like every show they said had shut down, had already shut down. And
wow.
So we shot like one more day. We shot some material that made it. We had shot out of order because of Michael's schedule. We shot out of order. So we'd already shot 21 and 22 and we'd shot through 18. My episode was 19. So 19 and 20 never got shot.
Wow.
But what we were able to do was shoot a little bit more material to make the end of 18 and the beginning of 21 so that those two episodes could run together without feeling like you'd skip 2 episodes of story.
Oh, that's
good. Yeah. So it turned out well, and the episode was fun.
Is something like COVID, like, this is so unprecedented, so maybe you can't even answer this, but are shows in fear of being canceled over this? Because of the long drought of it?
100%.
Yeah.
This happens with strikes too, but even more with this. It's very scary for shows. I mean, honestly, I'm not going back to Prodigal because I was really only brought on to work on those 9 episodes at the end of season 1. And it's going to be very difficult for them to start up again because the show shoots in New York.
You're right.
And I don't think they'll make it onto the fall schedule. I think they're now hoping to come back. This is all like, I'm not sure.
It's all speculative.
You know, this is all I'm not on the show anymore.
Yeah.
So let me be clear. This is all speculation.
Right.
But I did not see them on the fall schedule. And I noticed that a lot of shows that shoot in New York are now looking to be maybe mid-season shows this year.
Wow.
And a lot of the shows that got greenlit early on, a lot of them shoot in Canada because they, you know, Canada didn't get hit nearly as hard.
Right.
And so it's going to be tough. It's going to be really tough to remount these shows. We as an industry are going to have to figure out how to do our jobs safely. And it's unprecedented. So it's just like, you know, we got to figure out all new methods of production, ways to minimize contact between people, ways to minimize the number of people on the set, who's on set, who's wearing masks. Everybody's probably wearing masks except the actors. How often are people getting tested? The actors are probably going to have to be tested frequently, maybe even once a week.
Wow.
Maybe even once a day. I don't know.
Yeah.
But basically, like, because the actors are going to need to be close to each other, you know, in an enclosed area in order to do
right.
scenes.
You can't shoot scenes after scene of everybody 6 feet apart from each other.
No, you just can't. And even that, like, isn't as effective if you're in an enclosed space. So the actors are going to need to be screened. It's going to be really challenging, and I know we'll manage it and we'll get through it,
you know,
but it's going to take some doing, and it probably is going to mean that maybe there'll be less episodes of every show because it's going to take longer to produce each episode.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a lot of like, people are going to be like, well, why are there only 20 episodes of this show? Usually there's 21 or 22 or 23, or why are there only, you know, why are there only 17?
Right.
Well, you know, because why did they do that? Well, they did that because usually they can shoot one every 8 days, and now it takes them 10 days to shoot an episode.
Do you think they'll take more of a European model? Like, you know, in Britain, it's 8 episodes a year, you know, 9 episodes, 6 episodes, like the IT crowd. You got 4 seasons and there's like 6-7 episodes a season.
I think there'll be more of that. Already there's more of that on streaming for sure, right?
Yeah.
But I think that there's still an appetite for, like, you know, I think people will still happily watch 22 episodes of Flash, you know, if they can do 22 episodes of Flash.
Right.
I think that there is still an appetite in the United States for those kind of things where you've got like a show that you can watch once a week, or you can binge it for like, you know, a few weekends in a row or whatever.
It's hard. I grew up a TV watcher like all of us, I guess. But you know, sometimes those shows just grab you and I don't want them to end, you know? And
yeah,
having 6 episodes isn't enough.
Well, and also, like, when you have only 6 episodes or 8 or even 10, the thing that I find you lose are those kind of standout episodes that feel like they're something completely different from the rest of the series, or that they're just their own special little 1 hour movie, you know? And they're not just driving the arc of the series forward.
Yeah.
Like Hush, right? On Buffy. Like, if you were doing 10 episodes of Buffy a year, would you have done Hush? I don't think you might not have.
Right.
Would you have done the musical episode? Maybe not.
Yeah, right. You know, you want to get those wonderful episodes that you never knew what it was sitting there.
Yeah, there's a lot of Deep Space Nine episodes that, you know, there's 176 Deep Space Nine episodes.
That's a lot.
And it's a lot. And probably, I don't know, 70 of them drive the overall story, right?
Right.
You could probably boil Deep Space Nine down to 70 episodes that really tell the entire tale.
Right.
Of the show. But the episodes you're going to throw away are going to be The Visitor, The Wire.
Right.
You're going to throw away Far Beyond the Stars.
I feel like those episodes that you're talking about, and like in comic book terms, they would be inventory episodes or inventory issues where they have them pre-written and they're just in a drawer. So then when a project team is taking that month off, then they have an issue that they can release that isn't affecting any arc, right? But
yeah,
that's your character development in a lot of ways. And that's what's so great about television is that you have all these ancillary episodes that build your characters up.
100%. And like also ones that experiment with form.
Yeah.
Ones that do something like Hush, where like there's no dialogue because the gentleman, I think it's whatever, they're basically making it so you can't speak.
Right.
You know, or an episode like The Visitor, which plays with time and where we've got an adult Jake and it's told from his point of view and Cisco's appearing, you know?
Yeah.
Like those kind of experimental, like cool things that really exist as like their own little movies.
Right.
You know, their own little like 42 minute story that's completely self-contained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your chance, you know, to experiment.
Yeah. Like what's the X-Files episode with the demons talking in the bar?
Oh, I know that one, which X-Files is such a blur now.
Yeah. But like, there's so many great memorable X-Files episodes too, that are just like the weird standalone ones, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what shows lose when they just go completely like 10 episodes, all one story, let's go, you know?
Yep.
And to me,
I agree. It's
you're losing those episodes. And it's like, it becomes a rare exception when you get one of those episodes that you can remember one episode individually of that show.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the Watchmen episode, you know, which one I'm talking about, like the Hood, you know, the Hood of Justice one.
Oh, yeah.
Like
that is a
standout freaking episode of television.
Yeah.
It's a great show, but it has, in my mind, it has one standout episode where it's not like the other 9 episodes are sort of like one big continuous thing that sort of tells one story. And I can't remember necessarily which episode is episode 3 and which episode is episode 4 and what happened in which one. Right. I remember the show and it was great, but I remember that episode.
Regina King.
And those are the kind of things that, or the Fly episode in Breaking Bad, you know?
Oh yeah.
Those, I mean, that episode has nothing to do with continuity.
Nothing.
But it's a freaking great, great episode of television, you know?
What TV shows are you watching right now?
Well, like I said, I just finished The Boys.
Yeah.
I've been watching a little bit of Discovery on and off. I watched a couple of those the other night.
I like Discovery. I know some people are kind of poo-pooing it for some reason. I can't figure out why, because it's a great Star Trek show.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a great cast, and I think, you know, it's good writing, and it looks beautiful. It's beautiful looking.
Have you watched Picard yet?
It's enjoyable. I have. I watched all of Picard. I enjoyed that. I'm watching What We Do in the Shadows.
I love that show. Oh, my God. I laughed so hard at that show.
So freaking funny. And
Barry is a genius.
Dead to Me. My wife and I just watched Dead to Me. We watched the first season of that show.
I haven't watched that yet. Great. Is it good? It's worth it?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's definitely soap. You know, it's definitely a soap. It's a melodrama.
Yeah.
I like those too. Like, the
performances are good, and there's some great funny, you know, it's very dark.
Yeah.
But there's some very funny moments in it. And very great and great characters. Yeah, so I watch all kinds of stuff, you know.
I got a question for you.
Legend of Korra.
Huh? Which one?
You know, watching that? Legend of Korra? Avatar Legend of Korra?
Oh, yeah. That just dropped on Netflix with Avatar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or so was it on before and then they dropped Avatar?
I haven't watched all of Korra, and so I'm trying to grab that when I can.
Yeah, that one. I just finished up. My nephew is here. He's 25. I'm 45. So he was like 10 or 11 when Avatar was released, the first time. Yeah. So it's right up his wheelhouse, right? He loves it.
Oh, yeah.
And so he's been binge watching it. I've been watching it with him. So now after this is done, I'm gonna go and watch Legend of Korra.
Yeah, Avatar is so good. It's so fun.
The writing's so great. It's like, what?
Yeah.
You actually care for the characters. It's not like, you know, I don't know. It's not just – there's just few animated cartoons like that. Animated cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's very rare. Like, that's one of the best pieces of epic fantasy in television in the last, like, 20, you know.
Yeah.
It's right up there. It's pretty terrific.
Hey, man, is Aztec Conquest ever going to get made or what?
No, probably not. Serpent and the Eagle?
Ron no, Howard! Unfortunately.
I don't think that'll ever get made.
Still own it?
Ron, I don't even know if Imagine still owns it. Paramount bought it for them. It's one of those things that's like got a lot of rights encumbrances against it. I would love to get it done. I mean, Hans tried to get it done as a miniseries there for a minute, and it looked like that might happen. So, you know, there's still a chance. There's always a chance. I love that script. I was very, you know, I was very proud of it. I thought Hans.
Well, I heard you talk about it, and obviously you can't go and, you know, I don't have a copy to read it, obviously.
No.
But listening to you talk about it and talking about the concubine and that she's one of the most hated historical figures in Mexico. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. How is this not a movie?
It's a great story. And, you know, that all comes from Hans. Despite his name, Hans Beimler, Hans is Mexican. He was born and raised in Mexico City.
Yeah.
So that all comes from him. You know, that's
awesome.
That was all like initially his, like, he was the one who told me the story. And I was like, that's a movie. We should friggin' write that.
Yeah.
And so we did. My feature career has been a series of disappointments, man.
Did you have some other ones that just didn't get to where you needed to be?
That's the one that hurts. That's the one that hurts the most.
Yeah.
But the movie that like got me the Star Trek gig in the first place, the script I wrote for that was this thing called Splicers, which is like a futuristic Spartacus.
Okay.
I mean, you know, genetically engineered soldiers who are about to, who realize they're going to be like essentially recycled for parts.
Yeah.
Because they've got like the next generation's ready to go. And so there's a slave uprising.
Yeah. It's awesome.
It's pretty, I would love to see that one get made. That one almost got made with Denzel Washington at one point was going to play the lead.
Oh, wow. That would have been amazing.
Would have been pretty cool. That was like, geez, that was like 20 years ago now. I sold this like 10 little engines in space, 10 little engines on an International Space Station thing to John Woo and Sony back in the day. That never got made. John Woo, unfortunately, like lost his interest in doing American movies and sort of lost favor in Hollywood a little bit. And then he went back to China and all kinds of great stuff.
Was that after Face Off? Is that when he lost
it? It was after Face Off. No, Face Off, he was riding high. Like, people loved that movie and it did really well. No, it was after, unfortunately, it was after Wind Talkers. And I think Wind Talkers didn't do very well. It disappointed.
Oh, and that Eraser was the Vietnam story.
And so it was right around that time when he was doing Windtalkers and Eraser. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, that and Mission Impossible 2, I think.
Was it two or three that he did?
I love him. I think he's a terrific director, and I love that project too.
But his style is cool.
Yeah, super cool. Super great style. And when he had a great script, like he would just knock it out of the park.
Dude, Hardboiled. I've watched Hardboiled so many times.
Oh, I love Hardboiled so much. And The Killers is so but my favorite is actually Bullet to the Head, which
oh, I don't think I've seen that one.
Never seen it. It's about four kids from Hong Kong who go to Vietnam during the Vietnam War to try to like make a quick buck, I think running fucking heroin or something like that. And yeah, it just all goes to hell. It's pretty great. And
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, you should. It's pretty good. It's pretty cool. Yeah. So like, you know, I've got another one right now. I've got a feature that this very cool producer, I can't tell you who it is. I mean, it's sort of this off the wall thing where there's this producer who's well known in a different media but they have a film deal. And they read the script of mine and really dug it. And so we're trying to get a director attached to it right now.
Oh, good luck, man. So, fingers crossed.
Yeah, we'll see. It would be nice. I'd love to finally get a feature made.
Yeah.
But yeah, but Serpent and the Eagle is the one that one still kills me.
So it's still just like a little knife to the side.
You heard the saddest part of that story?
No.
I'll tell you the saddest part. Oh, okay. Well, here's the saddest part. So I hope everyone is following along, but basically Hans Beimler from Deep Space Nine and I wrote this movie called Serpent and the Eagle, which was a giant retelling of the conquest of Mexico. Epic.
Okay.
And we sold it to Ron Howard, who's going to direct it. And he was really into it. And then he actually did a soft prep, and we hired a Mexican producer. He went and scouted some locations. We lined up a costumers, makeup artists. The producer down there in Mexico struck a deal with the Mexican army to provide extras to be like the Aztec army.
Oh, wow.
They were going to rebuild sections of Tenochtitlan and Veracruz, I think.
I didn't know you guys got this far into this.
None of this happened, but like the budgeting was all done and the deals were all sort of lightly papered. And then Russell Crowe was like, hey, I want to make that Cinderella Man boxing movie. And then, they just won Academy Awards with Beautiful Mind. So are you not going to do that? And then they offered him Da Vinci Code. And then, you know, it's just like, he just got other things that were closer to creation, like bigger, flashier things. And
yeah,
you know, unfortunately it kind of went off the rails. And I don't blame anybody. It's just, that's the way it works sometimes.
Well, how can you, right? It's just,
but here's the ass kicker.
Okay.
So about 6 months after everything for Serving the Eagle looks like it's basically dead, Mel Gibson shows up in Mexico with this script called Apocalypto.
Yeah.
And he hires the same line producer.
Oh, God.
And she dusts off all the prep for Serving the Eagle and hands it to Mel Gibson. And so if you want to know
what
the Eagle would have looked like, just watch Apocalypto. Because that's our costumer, our makeup people, our locations, our sets.
No.
Like everything we had planned to build for our movie. There it is.
What?
On screen. Yep.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yep. Robert, what? That's a kick in the head, dude.
Oh, man.
Oh, man.
Apocalypto looks pretty good, doesn't it?
It looks great.
Pretty awesome movie.
Yeah, it looks great. They did a great job on it.
Completely different. Completely different plot. His is like pre-conquest. It's about the Mayan. It's a great movie. I really enjoy it.
Right.
Ours was Cortez and Moctezuma, and Cortez's Aztec mistress was actually the hero of the movie. So ours is completely different. It would have been a completely different movie, but yeah, you can sort of see what our movie would have looked like if you watch Apocalypto.
Oh my God.
Well,
and then the whole thing with Mel Gibson happens like not too far after that.
Yeah. I don't know. Not something I want to get into.
No, I don't want to get into that either. It's just crazy that all these events all like boom, 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 boom. That's just crazy, man.
I mean, the business is crazy. Like it's just a crazy business. If you think about like what it is to make a film, right?
Yeah.
You've got it or a season of television. It's a $100 million spec house basically, if you think about it. Like, you're basically building one of the most expensive houses in the world and hoping people will want to live in it. and you're hiring like 200 like skilled union laborers to build that house, right?
Yeah, right.
You're taking a year at least of actual work, you know, plus maybe another 4 or 5 months of prep
right.
to make that house, and you're spending, you know, $50-100 million. I mean, a season of Elementary, I mean, you know, 22 episodes times some number, indeterminate number, which I can't say between, you know, but probably, you know, more than a million, less than 10,
right.
you know,
right.
But you do the math, you're spending like, you know, you're spending close to $100 million on that or wow. any kind of movie these days, you know, $200-300 million.
It's so
and
nutty.
So the stakes are super high and everything just has to like click just right. You know, that's the luck thing again, right? It
right.
all has to hit. And, you know, and anyone who's been in the business as long as I have has had some really terrific luck and some really crappy luck too.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible though, man. I can't believe you guys set up all this up. Nothing works. I mean, it doesn't work out. That's just the best way to put it, right? It doesn't work out. And then another movie idea comes along and they're like, oh, look, we have all this stuff already set up, ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, Hans and I got paid very nicely. We got paid it for a year to work on that movie, maybe a year and a half.
Yeah.
We were super excited, and you know, if things had gone perfectly, you know, we might have gotten our gold statues. We might have a great, you know, great credit that we could point to.
Right.
It didn't happen. You know.
Well, here's the next
idea. The way of the world. You know,
yeah.
Just, well, it's also this... been a total disaster. Like maybe it would have gotten on the screen and been terrible. I doubt it. I mean, Ron right. is a really talented guy.
Well,
but you know,
it sounded amazing when you were talking about it. I watched you on. It was like a little YouTube writers thing.
Oh my God, that must have been like 10 years ago or yeah. something at least.
Yeah, and the interviewer guy seemed like a nice guy, but he seemed uber uncomfortable. Which he made it reminded me of the Chris Farley sketch with Paul McCartney. Do you remember when you did?
I don't know that one. I don't think.
Oh,
I think
God,
that might have been one of the ones that was on during the time I had no time to watch that.
it's so classic. But I mean, but the guy asked some good questions, and you and some of the information I got here today was from that. So
there awesome. You
go. Yeah,
yeah. I think that was done at the writer's store, which is literally like no longer in business. I mean, it's gone. It was right down the street from where I live.
Oh, what's the writer's store? What was that?
It was in Westwood, and it was like this great store where you could buy like all these books on screenwriting and television. You could buy scripts, and you could buy like, you know, they had Final Draft and Screenwriter or whatever. They had all the software for sale, and they had classes and seminars and stuff. It was really cool. I mean, you know, retail is also very hard.
Yeah.
And I think they moved most of their stuff online.
You got to do what you got to do to stay in business, I guess.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, you know, it was a cool store.
I'm getting bummed out by the even the big box stores that are closing. I'm getting bummed out because I want to go and feel what I'm going to buy and have that tactile experience with it as opposed to just seeing it online and go, okay, yeah, that sounds good. It's kind of sucks.
It kind of does. I miss like even the big box bookstores and stuff. I miss like walking in and touching books. Although, to be fair, I mostly buy ebooks now or Audible books because I'm sort of like, I don't need the physical thing anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to do a Picardo though. And I'm going to say like, you got one more question. Cause I got to go grab my dinner.
You know what? It's kind of funny. I was just looking at the time. I was literally just going to tell you, Robert, we've been on for over an hour already.
I think we're good. I think this turkey is cooked.
I think so. I really appreciate you coming on board, man. It was a lot of fun chatting with you. As books come out that you're doing and new things are on the horizon, I'd love to have you back on. I think we had a really fun time.
I had a really fun time talking with you guys. So yeah, likewise. So next time I have something that's worth talking about, I'll let you know.
Perfect. Thanks, man. Hey, have a good dinner.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. And we're back.
We're back.
Same time.
Oh, such man. Dorks.
That was
Robert's
fun.
Cool, huh? We both said a statement slash question, and then we both stopped talking.
Yep.
Because we thought each other were going to answer each other because we said it at the same time.
And I have no idea what you asked. I also forgot what I asked. So we're
you
good.
Said that was fun. I said he's cool.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah. Robert was a cool guy or is a cool guy. Nothing's happened to Robert. Don't freak out.
Right.
But yeah, he's a cool guy. That was a lot of fun. And guy has done a ton in the industry for TV. And now he's writing books.
He's just done a ton everywhere,
now.
Man.
He's been writing books and he's always writing. So, man, I'm always jealous of people like that.
Yeah.
You know, because I've tried to start writing this, start writing that. That's why I'm excited to work on the project that you and I are trying to do.
Oh, yeah. It's
because
so much fun.
We can write together. And then maybe that will keep me on track and actually finishing, you know?
Well, I mean, hearing other people's journey makes you do it.
Yeah, yeah. But some people, man, they're just able to sit down and just start writing. And, man, I'm just jealous of that because it's like, how, you know, I have all these ideas in my head and then I start writing it out. And then it's like trying to get it out of my head seems to be, I think I get, you know what it is? I get lost in the grammar and the syntax. I worry about the grammar and syntax.
Yeah, well, I think, so, yeah, yes. But honestly, to get over that hump of just doing it, you just got to just start writing, right? You can always fix shit in editing. You just got to start writing.
That's right. That's right. I know. Well, that's 100% right. But then I still get frustrated. You know what I mean?
Well, knock it off.
I'm trying.
This is my motivational speech. Just knock it off.
Just knock it off. All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that. Robert, thank you so much for coming on. You were a pleasure to talk to. If you guys enjoyed that, please go to spoilerverse.com. Check out our back issues. There's a ton of cool stuff to check out. And we have a lot of other podcasts that are also hosted at spoilerverse.com, like Bridging the Geekdom and Shooting the Sith and Misery Point Radio and Polygon Warriors and Funny Book Forensics.
Dude,
and
so much.
Narrative Gunslinger.
Yep, that's right. You said it right. Yes. This time. Good job. And we've got articles and reviews and previews and press releases from all across the globe from our amazing writing staff and writing team. And we've got so much more. You just got to go and check it out. We have a store link where you can buy t-shirts or hoodies or face masks because you want to cover your face right now because that's a smart, nice thing to do. And if you don't believe me, just listen to Eminem and Kid Cudi's new song where they will shame you if you don't wear face masks. It's really good. And you can buy all that money you buy and spend on us. We get a little bit of kickback for it, and it helps us pay our server fees and our fees here to keep the site going for you.
Keep the lights on, as they say.
Yep.
All right, guys. We're out. And so don't forget,
in oceans of podcasts,
we are Cthulhu.
And as Cthulhu compels you to do,
open the mind
and read more.
Open the mind.
No, it's open the mind.
I gotta open the mind.
All right, bye.